Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back. We want to talk now about uncertainty.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
That was former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld talking about Iraq, those words from back in 2002. Well, UMass Memorial's Dr. Stephen Hatch argues that those words should also apply to medicine. Dr. Hatch says it's time to ditch the model of doctor knows best and to replace it with a more honest discussion of what doctors know and what they don't know. In his new book, Snowball in a Blizzard, he writes that uncertainty lies at the heart of what physicians do on a daily basis. And Dr. Hatch joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Deborah.
So the premise of your book is there's a lot of haziness in the world of medicine than most people, both patients and doctors, understand. Can you explain a little bit in broad terms why you say that?
Sure. I think it stems from the simple fact that most tests are not 100% accurate one way or the other. And then from that, there are a variety of consequences that are not commonly understood in the public dialogue about medicine, but also even within the medical community itself. One of the main features that I try to discuss in the book as sort of the poster child for that problem is the issue of mammograms, which has now for really the better part of a decade been a major bone of contention, and there's a lot of misunderstanding around it.
Right. So essentially what you say, and you kind of rehash this, for folks who don't know, in 2009, right, the recommendations came out that maybe women don't need mammograms as frequently as first believed and at a certain age, is it under 50?
Exactly.
And this created a great deal of backlash because, obviously, breast cancer is very frightening. There are a lot of women with breast cancer, and people were scared about this. So why do you think that this is such a great example of uncertainty?
So the title of the book, Snowball in a Blizzard, comes from a joke that radiologists have about the difficulties of mammogram interpretation. The joke is that finding a tumor in a mammogram is as difficult as finding a snowball in a blizzard. And what it reveals is the difficulties associated with interpreting all medical data, and that there are potential downsides to finding things that aren't actually there. And then we offer to patients treatments that may end up harming patients who never had a disease in the first place.
So you're saying that more frequent mammography could result in interventions that could actually result in surgical, perhaps mastectomies even, for some women who may not have needed them?
That was exactly the reasoning that the task force used back in 2009.
Mm-hmm. But they also save lives, correct?
Which makes mammograms a very, very difficult technology because almost all of the studies have shown a life-saving benefit, but they also show that there are some downsides to screening a wide population.
Hmm. So I think if someone were weighing this, they might say, well, we could risk the fact that some women may have an unnecessary surgical intervention, or we might risk that some women might die. I think if you're going to weigh those, wouldn't you say maybe an unnecessary surgical intervention is not quite as serious as someone dying?
So what I try to bring up in the book is not to take my own personal editorial stance, but to explain to people what the logic was of the controversy itself. Mm-hmm. I think my own feeling is that what doctors should be able to do is explain to their patients why these recommendations are what they are so that the patient can make an informed decision that they feel like they're in control of their health.
Mm-hmm. So, but wouldn't a patient always sort of err toward that, I'll do whatever, I'll take the risk if it means it might be life-saving?
I think if patients want to do that and a doctor can explain why there are, right now, at present, there are competing recommendations for women under 50, I think the job of a physician is to explain to them what the size of the benefit is and what the size of the risks are. And if patients at the end of the day do conclude that they would rather have annual mammograms versus every other year, then that's a reasonable conclusion.
Hmm. You know, you told a story in the book, in the very beginning of the book, which I found fascinating, and that was about a psychiatry experiment from the 1970s from Dr. Rosenhan. Am I saying that correctly? Can you explain that experiment? Because I had never heard of it before.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the sort of infamous experiments devised in the history of medicine. There was a man named Rosenhan who had decided to try to see if psychiatric doctors were actually good at finding a sane person in the midst of a psychiatric facility. So he had people who had no history of psychiatric illness present to these facilities saying that they had had a transient auditory hallucination. They had heard a voice, but the voice had stopped speaking to them, and they felt fine since. There were eight patients. All eight of them were admitted. They were given the most profound labels of psychiatric illness, and they were held for varying lengths to treat this illness that didn't exist. The shortest, I think, was a week, and the longest was nearly 2 months.
In psychiatric hospitals.
In psychiatric hospitals.
And nobody seemed to notice that they were sane. It's like a nightmare, right? One flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Exactly. Right? Mm. And what was interesting is the people, there was actually a group who realized that they were sane, and that was the patients themselves.
The patients, and not the medical professionals.
Not the medical staff.
Mm. And so, essentially, though, I mean, you know, obviously it's very simplistic to say this, but are you saying that many times the medical profession just doesn't recognize what's going on right before because it's so eager to diagnose and look at things in a data-driven way that these kinds of things might happen?
I think that there are some psychological influences that make us very conservative about wanting to catch diseases. So we start to see patterns that don't necessarily exist. And I think we have to be cautious about data interpretation when we do that, both as physicians and as patients.
You know, you also mentioned Lyme disease in your book. And there's big, obviously, we're in New England, big controversy about Lyme disease and diagnosing and treating and chronic fatigue syndrome. Why is this an example, do you think, of uncertainty?
So within the field of Lyme disease, there are actually a great deal of elements of uncertainty when a person comes in the middle of summer and they're not feeling well. The testing may or may not be good in that kind of a situation. What happens with Lyme disease, and you mentioned chronic fatigue syndrome, is that as patients get further and further out with their symptoms, two things happen that we actually become increasingly more certain of. One is a negative test for Lyme disease in that kind of a situation actually carries a great deal of value. And the second thing is, we've known from multiple studies that giving people antibiotics for extended periods of time does not help improve patients in that situation. Those are the two things that we're actually quite certain of. And yet there's been really a whole alternative group that continuously tries to indicate to people that there's real controversy out there in the mainstream medical community when there's actually very little controversy about that, those two points.
Hmm. You know, do you almost muddy the water a bit, if you will? Because I feel that a lot of patients maybe already realize that there are alternative medicine sources. There's all kinds of information on the internet. We can look up a variety of things. Many people are self-diagnosing, and then they go to their doctors and they say, I found X, Y, and Z. And at least from my own anecdotal personal experience, sometimes a doctor may feel challenged and may not welcome the fact that a patient, and we've certainly had folks write about this on our Cognoscenti page at WBUR, the doctors say that they're feeling like many of their patients now believe that they understand so much about medicine that they feel challenged and their expertise is challenged. Do you, by saying that there's all this uncertainty and medical professionals don't know, doesn't that almost increase that in a way? And are doctors going to be more welcoming of folks asking questions about that uncertainty?
Yeah, it's a great question.
It's a very long-winded one.
What I talk about toward the end of the book is a situation where the same thing happened to me, not as a patient, but as the family member of a patient. And I got exactly that kind of rather condescending, off-putting behavior. And as you don't need me to tell you that everybody's got a story about when doctors acted in that way. Mm. What I'm hoping to do is provide a framework so that both patients and doctors can understand when it's okay to say, you know, that I'm not 100% certain, and to say what is known or what is not known about a particular topic, rather than make it an all or nothing binary deal between the patient and the doctor. I think doctors do need to be aware that patients come in the age of the internet much more prepared with lots of information. And where I bring the expertise is not, and I should say I, but all doctors, mm-hmm. where they bring their expertise is the ability to contextualize the information that patients are bringing.
And that's how patients should look at it, and that's how doctors should look at it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's my hope.
Yeah. Are doctors taught that way, though?
One of the ways in which doctors are trained is by answering correct questions when they go through their pre-med studies and then they get to medical school. And the tests are mainly find the right answer out of multiple wrong answers. And then you get out into practice and you discover that it's much more subtle than that. And I think that we need to consider how we train the next generation of physicians to make them more aware of these issues.
And what was your story about your relative where you felt that the doctors were condescending? And
So this person was a close family member who had had what's called sudden cardiac death and had been revived by the emergency medical technicians. The person had a do not resuscitate order and had had long conversations with his primary care physician about not wanting to have all of the things that we can do to keep a person alive be done to him. And all of a sudden, the machine kicked in, and that is the medical machine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was intubated. He was kept alive. And when our family went to discuss with the doctor to say, he's got a do not resuscitate order, they said, well, he's on a hypothermia protocol. And I was the only person who had advanced training in medicine, and everybody looked at me and I said I didn't know what a hypothermia protocol was. I had been out of intensive care medicine for a while at that point. So I had to and they really basically stiff-armed our requests. And eventually I had to read up on the literature, and what I found is that hypothermia protocols make a very, very small difference. They do make an observable, definable difference in outcomes, but basically your outcomes go from incredibly bad in a situation like that to just very bad. And once I understood that, and yet they were treating it as if it was an obvious game changer, we went back to them and said, you know, these were his wishes. This is what he wanted out of the system.
Hmm. And then it was they listened, but it took they stiff-armed you, and you had to kind of meet that challenge and go right back at them and say, no, this is what we want.
Yeah.
What was the thinking then behind that, do you think?
Their thinking?
Mm-hmm.
I think their thinking was that this was an obviously useful technology that should just be done without any question at all. It was exactly that kind of reflexive thinking rather than a more flexible way of saying, well, we can do this, but it's been proven to help a very small amount. Mm-hmm. Because what this person wanted was not to be intubated and not to be in an intensive care unit.
And this relative was?
This was my father.
Mm-hmm. That must have been awful.
It wasn't great. It made his final days tough because of the tension within our own family, and we didn't really want to be fighting with doctors over it.
Right, right. So the message from that you give to people is?
It's important to continue to talk with your doctors. It's important to understand what your goals are, and it's important to assert yourself. And hopefully the doctors will respond in kind. We eventually got them onto the same page as us.
All right. Dr. Stephen Hatch is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, working in the Division of Infectious Disease and Immunology. His book is Snowball in a Blizzard, A Physician's Notes on Uncertainty in Medicine. Dr. Hatch, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Deborah.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.